remembering the overall context of our practice, being compassion and the wish to free all beings from all difficulties. We sit here for and with everyone. One practice we can do to remember this is to dedicate the merit of everything we do to the awakening of all beings. So we can do this briefly at the period, end of every period of Zazen. It's possible to, you know, especially if we feel like this was, I really enjoyed this period. I dedicate the merit, this positive energy from this period to all beings. But even if we didn't enjoy it, even if we felt like it was a really distracted period, still we dedicate our effort. And even if we feel like we weren't even making any effort, we dedicate still the fact that we're here in this room doing this practice. And you can just silently say it to yourself as we bow at the end of a period, I dedicate any merit, anything positive coming from this period, I offer it. That's what dedication of merit is. I offer anything positive from the last 40 minutes to the awakening and happiness of all beings. And it just shifts our mind a little bit. It opens it up. Opens up to this larger context that we're not just practicing our little way in our little body and mind for ourselves. Also, as it's the fourth day of Sesshin, just to mention this practice, not necessarily an encouragement to do so, but because it might not have ever occurred to you. There's a practice called night sitting. People who've sat at Tassajara probably know this. Yaza, night sitting. And it's an ancient tradition to, in Sesshin, as the days go on and things might be getting more difficult and painful, but also some power of concentration is building also. Or even if we feel like it's not, our sense of holding back starts to get worn away. And we can, after the formal schedule ends at 9 p.m., we can continue to sit. So often the style at a place like Tassajara or the monastery I practiced in Japan was people would go take a break, go to the bathroom, whatever, come back to the zendo and continue to sit informally, no bells, no lights on, and just get up when it's time to get up and go. Here we have some people sleeping in the zendo, so it might be okay with them if people sat here. But also, I think particularly in a place like this where we're basically, we have commuter sesshin, that it's a nice opportunity to make that transition home, to drive or bike or walk home to that other location where sesshin is still continuing, but we might have forgotten that. And because we might have forgotten that, to before going to sleep, to just sit a little bit, even just a few minutes, because we're making that transition into another kind of like our habitual dwelling place. and to not go to sleep with a kind of scattered mind, we can sit a little bit or a lot of bit. I just offer that possibility. I think there's some, and it's a spirit cultivating practice too, because sometimes we might be like, finally, the last period ended, 9 o'clock. I am like so to bed now. And we go home and we just like beeline, dive into the bed and finally. And I think there's to treat the whole 24 hours as a kind of a practice, and to that, not in the sense of like, you know, grasping the bed, but to ease into sleep, the meditation of sleep. We could even sit in bed. Continuing to explore calm abiding, shamatha, calm abiding or tranquility or settledness, one great half of Buddha's meditation. It's not the whole story. There's vipassana, insight, seeing that can be conjoined with this calm abiding. But we need this basis of calm abiding. We really, this is our emphasis. So the practice of counting the breath and following the breath and then letting go of the breath, these three practices of calm abiding we've been talking about. And it's not necessarily so sequential, like the first day, I've been kind of talking about it like this, that the first day we're counting the breath, the second day, now we can follow without counting, now we can let go of even the following. It can be in a period of zazen. And depending on where our mind is at, if we feel not so present, kind of scattered, come back to this basic counting the breath. It's the strongest tool to really focus. And I was talking with someone about how even with counting, it's easy to get pulled away between the numbers. We might feel like there's a lot of space, a lot of time in between one and two, for example. But we can extend that one on the out breath, visualizing the number one even, or the sound, the internal sound of the word one, all the way out to the very end. And if we're really scattered, you can even on the in-breath too. Another one, and then two, you know, or 1A, 1B. The more we have to focus on, the less room there is for the mind to wander elsewhere, but also the more of a chore it is. So the more subtle we get, the less we want to completely occupy the mind every moment with some object like this. So as Juri says, we've been studying this text of the six Dharma gates to the sublime, or the six subtle Dharma gates, how the transition happens between the first gate of counting, the second gate of following, and the third gate of stopping. Basically, when it starts to seem like a chore, when counting starts to seem like too much extra work, unnecessary, because we're already concentrated, let go of the numbers, just follow the breath on the deep exhalation. And when following might seem like also too much, he says here, I don't know if I would have chosen that metaphor that he uses about wanting to go to sleep, because, you know, it's just a metaphor, but we shouldn't even bring up the issue of sleepiness around shamatha. But that's what he uses. Jiri says, one becomes aware of following as a course activity. Following the breath becomes a course activity. One becomes aware of it as that. So this can be like, there's some intention behind this, but it's a very subtle intention. It doesn't have to be like, okay, what's next? Okay, we're doing... It's more like an intuitive sense. You're quite concentrated. If not, then we're just counting the breath. But for following, and there's that sense, there's a little discursive checking mind that's saying, okay, we're doing okay here. We're pretty settled. And actually this following, one becomes aware of it as a course activity. The mind becomes somewhat averse to it and wishes to relinquish it. This is analogous to when a person has become exhausted and desires to sleep, thus causing him to be disinclined to deal with his many tasks. So maybe we should say, instead of sleep, how about just rest? A person's exhausted with this chore of following the breath and just wants to rest. Rest in shamatha.
I think I do want
to
sleep sometimes.
Well, then that's a little different.
I do almost fall asleep.
Yeah. Well, this is that does happen, right? So then we have to raise our energy. So at this point, in this case, we're quite concentrated and alert, and it just feels like too much effort. And then we let go, and then there's stopping, which is putting to rest all thought, taking anything as an object. One does not engage in counting or following the breath, just fixing the mind in the present, making it still. And the realization is one becomes aware of the body and mind seeming to vanish entirely as one enters into meditative absorption. And we talk about, so resting in nowness, we can call tranquility without support. So if we're using the breath, counting or following the breath, we call that shamatha, or calm abiding with support. The support is the breath. Sometimes we need the support, and we should use it when we need it. It's available to us. Shamatha with support, and shamatha without support is when we let go of the counting and following, unsupported by any particular object, we just rest in nowness. And again, without any particular object means there's still some subject-object relationship going on here. The object is what we call nowness, or the present. Continuously changing nowness. Now this point about sleepiness that Michael brings up is really important. So, particularly when we're talking about this unsupported tranquility. Because we need to distinguish that from just kind of blurry, hazy spacing out. So I think it's a nice exercise just for like a minute or so. Let's check out, I'll describe these two different kinds of meditation, and we'll just experience it right after the description right now. So the first one we could call stupid tranquility. It's not even really shamatha. It's not even really calm abiding. It's more like dullness or stupidity mind, the mind of kind of senseless, maybe stupidity training, we call it. And here's the instructions. You can try this out. you just sit really, really relaxed. You still sit upright, because we always say sit upright. Keep your posture, but relax completely and like really relax and let everything go. And actually, close your eyes is better for stupidity training. Just close your eyes, and like you've been in a hard day of work, and you're just, you know, you go to the beach and you're just resting on the beach, and very relaxed, as if you're falling asleep. Let yourself get really so relaxed that you might even fall asleep. Don't focus on anything at all. That's the key thing. Don't focus on the breath. Don't even try to be present. Just let go of all mental activity. And just relax completely. Getting sleepier. No object at all here. Very relaxed. This must be what they call shikantaza. Just sitting, doing nothing at all. And it's dark and dim, and the borderline between sleep and awake is very thin. Okay, so that might be often how we meditate sometimes, and we call it like, this is great, we're not even stuck on this breath thing, we're not counting or following the breath, we're just really relaxed and not thinking about anything, even though actually there might be this kind of dreamlike, blurry thinking going on. And we might just fall into like oblivion. And I think this is often what we think of as like just sitting. And that's to be contrasted with shamatha without support, unsupported tranquility. So here's the instructions for this one to compare. Same thing, we're sitting upright, keeping the posture. This time we leave our eyes open. That already is a different quality. Our eyes are open, and we're also really relax the body while sitting upright, eyes open. But now we really are attending to the object, we could say, of nowness. We're diligently resting the mind in this very moment. And it's not dull, we're actually intentionally bringing alertness and brightness to this present moment. And we're here, there's sound coming in, our senses are open. And if the mind veers off the present into some discursive thinking, we just return to this edge of this moment right now, relaxed and totally alert, bright and clear. Okay. So, did we do that long enough to get a sense for the difference between those two kinds of meditation? Stupidity training versus actual shamatha, calm abiding without support. Now, it may be that your mind is too active to actually just rest in the present like that, but sometimes for a minute like that, we can do it. And the difference is all about this brightness, alertness, and the sense gates open keep us bright and alert. And the eyes closed, we've fallen into a more dark, oblivion state. But in some ways, they're not that different. They're both sitting upright. They're both relaxed. It's just one is murky and one's clear. And it's all about intentionally bringing the alert clarity to the present. And if we're actually feeling physically sleepy, then maybe this practice, this unsupported shamatha, is maybe too much, because it'll just fall into the dull mind. Yes, Kathy?
You might think of it rather than stupidity training, it's just sleepy training.
Yeah.
It sounded remarkably like the hypnotape that I sometimes listen to when I'm really stressed out and I can't sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And so, it's an invitation into more of consciousness.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like
yeah. It does have its function.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
It feels more receptive too. It's like actively opening up to soften and receive.
The first one?
The first one, yeah.
Hmm.
The second one, I feel like I'm actively keeping a open container in a sense. You know, empty, bowl.
Yeah, it's actively, but still receptive. I think it's important to keep a really receptive quality to this clear resting in nowness, really devoted, dedicated to staying right in this moment, but with a quality of this open receptivity at the same time. And the senses being open is part of that.
It seems more like aware more than receptive to me anyway.
Hmm. I think sometimes if we're this dullness, sleepy training that is that first one, I think even if it's somewhat receptive, I think it can degenerate into actually kind of blocked, you know, where the eyesight is blocked, so that's not as receptive, but all the senses are kind of like almost shutting down as we move into sleep. The senses do kind of shut down. So it might at first seem a little more receptive, but I think in the end it gets kind of narrow and closed, and kind of like we're caving in on ourselves and curling into a kind of dark. It's very cozy. There's something very cozy and warm about it, which is why we're drawn there as humans, I think, into this. Especially in a like painful sesshin, it's one way of coping. You know, when the body is in pain, let's just kind of just like stop with too much effort. We just close. And we get into this closed space, whereas it might feel at first like to open in this really alert and relaxed way might feel like more struggle. But I'm proposing that actually this will give, if we're in pain and you know, physical or emotional, that this is an open way to actually, you know, really, really upright, open way to meet the moment. Yes.
Two words that come to mind are trance and vigilance.
There's
a real difference there.
Mm.
With trance, I'm not really inviting an interruption.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just trying to accommodate it.
Mm-hmm.
With vigilance, I am actively willing to meet what's there, but without prejudice, without without any object of the intention, just well, equanimity, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So the energy level is very different.
Yeah, I think that's true. It's like a like trance would be a way of talking about this first kind, and we're and this and the receptivity, open receptivity. In this case, when we're talking about just pure shamatha, we're not actually going to meet thoughts. We're letting in sensory, the five sense data, but actually discursive thinking. There's room for that in other types of meditation, but just in the shamatha, we're really letting go of any, you know, emotional content, mental content. We're letting that drop off as it arises. We could even say that we're letting it in just momentarily, just enough to let it go. But mainly, we're focusing on the vivid sense of nowness with no particular content, particularly discursive content. It may be that sounds come by, and so if we hear a car, it's okay to hear the sound, and I think even to, on some level, recognize that that's a car sound. That's not too disturbing to this present awareness. A car went by. But if we start to tell any further story about the car, that's getting into that's going to disturb this present tranquility. And unsupported is a nice way to say it, because unsupported practices are more difficult than supported ones. I think this is more difficult, and particularly it's offered in sesshin, where we're sitting a lot. I think in daily zazen, you know, if we're sitting one period a day or something, often that ends up being more like a maintenance of our well-being, and it's very valuable. But sesshin is this unique opportunity where we can really go beyond zazen as maintaining our basic well-being, going into these deeper realms of stillness. And so it may be that for people just arriving, we're talking about a whole day even of just counting the breath for, this was my practice the first day, for 24 hours, just counting 1 to 10. And then after a day of that, we have a different body and mind, and still we still get distracted, but we may then be able to follow the breath without counting. And then we can start experimenting with this letting, when we're settled, I think still we come in on the fourth day of sesshin, we can have really distracted zazen. I personally know I can. It really depends on the circumstances. I find it can be quite distracted zazen, but it's easier to come out of it, I find. And as sesshin goes on, it's kind of like, we're distracted, but we've been working with these tools so much, and it's like, okay, a breath. One, and it can be a really full, complete one, two, three, and we may be back. And then, at the beginning of a period, I've been kind of trying, counting a few, following a few, and then seeing if there's some relaxed presence, then let go into this no specific object, unsupported tranquility practice.
I like the 3 reps of 10 too. It's kind of like go to the gym, workout, and then
uh-huh.
See where you are.
Yeah,
yeah. To even get to 3, even get to 10 once. Hmm. Like this last period was the worst.
Hmm. Sometimes we really are just sleepy. That's part of it. And I think particularly the periods after meals, we're still digesting some. So, and then as the day goes on, we maybe wake up more. Sometimes they're really alert that first period. And whatever your practice is around resting and around tea drinking, which again, I wouldn't recommend or not recommend, but I personally break out the matcha during sesshin. And in ancient Zen practice. Also, to mention this context of things that support wakefulness, the larger picture of sesshin outside of zazen breaks are an important practice place. And very challenging, much more difficult than being in the zendo, although it might seem like a relief. So we really emphasize silence. And I know that's almost impossible. And we have various work things and tasks we're doing where we do communicate a little. Now, there are modes of practice that I think if people here want to try these, we can try them. They might seem a little obsessive, but there's one practice of basically writing everything by note, literally not opening your mouth for anything. So if the work leader has to do something like this, or can you do this after this? You just write it all in note, with lots of note passing back and forth. It's kind of tedious. So if people feel like that would be helpful, we could take it up. And it does have an effect. It really, we notice how our urge to speak is very strong. But I think without having to go to that extreme, we can speak a little when we need to. Like, can you wash the dishes over here? I'm going to do this. And then I think the advantage of doing it with speech is it's a training in speech that's to the point. To actually choose our words and have no extra explanations. Like, we don't need to explain the background of all our points that we're making. For example, if someone is assigning someone to dishes, can you wash the dishes because actually today this person is doing this other thing so they can't do them today? Actually, that person doesn't even need to know that. We have to trust, this takes some trust too, that we're all trying to work our way and that there is a reason for everything. So even if you, like if you can't, some people have schedules where they're coming and going. If you're telling me like I'm not going to be here this afternoon, I will trust that you have a good reason and you don't need to explain the circumstances. So very straightforward speech. It's hard, challenging, but I think it's a good practice in and of itself. So unless people really want to try a note writing practice, I'd say let's keep trying to work with verbal instructions, but really notice our urge to say something a little bit more than that. And also, this is not to get too harsh. This is all with great kindness. The reason we're minimizing our speech is to support each other's practice, because I think that actually this is the biggest thing that pulls us off during breaks. We can get into our own stories and our own distractions too, but I think the conversations, which are a beautiful part of human life, actually in this kind of a retreat, they pull us away from this non-discursive mind, because they're discursive by nature. So during breaks, maybe that's the main thing, and also just to treat breaks as practice in general. If you we say things like, if you take tea, to sit down and drink it in an upright posture, and to rest in a horizontal posture, but even treating all of that as practice, moving carefully, noticing how we're affecting others on this ship, this small ship in the ocean. And unhurriedly but decisively carrying on the next event. So back to shamatha, it has these qualities of mindfulness, present awareness, ease, and the quality of focusing on the object. That's why I think it's nice to say, instead of just to call this unsupported shamatha, if we say it's just being, we start to lose track that there's an object. And I think we really can say that there is an object called nowness. It's a specific object. It might seem a little undefinable. What's nowness? But it's a sense. It's a quality of being really present right now. That's an object, but the object is a lot less tangible than the breath, which is why it's more difficult. Unsupported tranquility. Yes.
But you know, as you're talking, I'm thinking that it itself is rather undefined, but not it is very clear. So you know, I mean, when the mind starts tripping it as it will, that's like, oh, hit the edge, not now.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm almost picturing like those paintings where, you know, the white, there's a whole white paper and then there's the black line, and the, you know, they define each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
I really appreciate you talking about the quality of now, because we tend to be kind of mysterious about that in Zen. Oh, well, you know, you just have to experience it.
Mm.
Actually, we can talk about it in some way.
Yeah.
And if you know what it isn't and stop doing what it isn't, then there is a difference.
That's a good point.
Between it and not it.
Yep. Yeah. To catch when we're off it, and then when you could even say, to carry that even further, that when we're really on it right now, we don't even, like, we can't actually get a hold of now. It's not something. So, which is why this not being able to get a hold of it is making this bridge towards vipassana, which we haven't started talking about yet. But in these three types of shamatha, the counting or the counting and following the breath, we call supported shamatha, and unsupported, of resting in nowness. The advantage of the unsupported shamatha is the transition to vipassana can be quite a subtle transition. Whereas from and vipassana, this insight is going to have to do with ungraspable emptiness. But when we're already don't have a more coarse support like the breath, we're already just resting in nowness, that's quite close to resting in emptiness. Not quite the same, but the leap is going to be a small leap, potentially. So that's why this advantage of, you could say, well, they're both just shamatha, they're both about being present and just focusing the mind. They're about tranquility and concentration, the support, supported and unsupported. But in Zen, this unsupported has a special place and special benefit, in that it's very similar in many ways to vipassana. And I think many people would even call it vipassana. So as we continue to speak about meditation, let's be clear about this very subtle distinction between shamatha, unsupported shamatha, unsupported tranquility, and insight, clear seeing, awakeness, and freedom. A fine line, but an important line, which we haven't gotten into this part yet. And let's also distinguish clearly this sometimes fine line between this, we won't call it stupidity then, we can call it sleepiness training. But something like that kind of, like, the dullness training, and clear, bright, sharp, resting in nowness, unsupported tranquility. That the line between those can sometimes get fuzzy. We can slip, if we're not following the breath, if we're practicing, intentionally practicing unsupported tranquility, it's easy for it to fall back into this dullness. So, let's keep, and the line between them is about clarity and alertness and present moment nowness. Yes, Rich.
This might be off topic, but something that happens to me, you had mentioned the sounds and maybe hearing a car and identifying it as having the identification of it has a car arise without making a story out of it. It needs a new gospel or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then another sense is vision. And however, when just sitting with eyes open, looking at with the eyes pointed at one particular spot, say being aware of light, then this thing happens where it's unidentifiable as a wall or as a corner of a somewhere, and then these colors. Spots start green, turning into purple, going like this. Is this something that other people have that just draws me in, and I can just let go of the breath and just watch this light show, and I don't want to go anywhere else. So where's that?
I actually coincidentally yesterday talked about light shows, Zazen light shows. And that I think it was in the context of resting in nowness is might, when we start to define, well, what is actually nowness? Well, it seems like what's happening right now, what is our experience right now? Well, it's five or six senses. That's our experience. And in Zazen, it's mainly the physical sense of the body, physical pains and discomforts, or bliss body, and sounds, and occasionally we can bring vision in there too. And so, but the thing about resting in nowness is, even though the senses are operating and they're open, we're letting in it, we're not fixating on any particular sense. So if we get obsessed with like changing the colors on the corner of the ton, which I know it's fun,
Open the other senses
and the sense of nowness. Even though that is happening right now, we could say we're too focused on the visual field. And that's why I think this more intangible point of nowness almost can't be, it is a slight fixation because it's a time to distinguish from other times, but it's less fixatable than the other senses. So the other sense data is coming in, but since they're all equally open, the attention's more on the nowness. And then the visual thing is happening. Okay, we let that happen, but we see we're getting caught in it. Okay, return to actually nowness. And nowness includes that, maybe.
And then
my body, too. I've totally lost track of that. So all the senses open, but the object is more like the nowness. Yeah.
Every sense has latency. It's not on or off. It's like peak and fade. And that fade is part of now too. Unless I chase it.
Yeah.
I say, what was that again? Then I'm not But letting it fade is part of
now. I think it can have a little fade, yeah. Yeah, I mean, this thing now is undefinable, and our experience might be that there's a little bit of like, you know, and we kind of like notice there's a breath, and it's more than just one moment, with like it's maybe three moments of noticing that we just sighed, and then, so that's the kind of the fade, but then, yeah, not sticking to it. And another point that makes me think of, and also Kathy's point about what it's not, is, and this is a, you might have heard this before. I thought this was really interesting when I first heard that we're talking about shamatha, which means calm abiding. We're not talking about, in this case, dhyana or samadhi even, you know, which would be like one-pointed concentration. That's there, but when we're talking about cultivating calm abiding, the main condition for this is not actually fixing the mind on a particular object. The main thing that actually calms the mind, literally deeply settles into the deep, peaceful realm, is not the fixing the mind on a particular object, but it's letting go of the other stuff. It's letting go of discursive thought. So, in other words, another way to say it is, it's more a non-doing than a doing. You know, to say like, okay, breath, I am not going to take my mind off this breath. I am like, you know, with great effort, I am grasping this breath with all my might. That's a kind of a doing practice. And that is concentrating. That does lead to concentration. But calm abiding is actually, we do have an object that we're focused on, but the emphasis, the main practice is discursive thought comes up, let go, release, 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 let go of the extra discursive thought. And that's what's calming, which is kind of, you might have a sense of that. Is this calming or is this calming? And wonderfully, this letting go of the discursive thought, it's calming and, of course, it's also concentrating. But it's a concentrating with less struggling effort, because it's a letting go, it's a releasing. So it's releasing, letting go, but not losing this vivid alertness, so we fall into the dullness. These sleepy meditations do have a function, like you mentioned, for like hypnosis, or if we're actually trying to sleep, we're really restless and trying to sleep, this tranquility without support would not be so advised, because it's very alert. We might stay up all night and having really great meditation and not thinking about anything maybe, but ideally we wouldn't fall asleep. But if we're trying to fall asleep at the end of the day, then it's very nice to like not focus the mind, to let the eyes close and let everything blur into a very comfy, cozy, hazy, warm dullness. sleep. So it could have those functions, but it wouldn't ever be considered like a Buddhist meditation. Even though I think sometimes we treat it that way, or we feel like at least we're not agitated. That's pretty good. this is Soknyi Rinpoche on the doorman during these types of shamatha. So calm abiding is like being a doorman, someone who opens the door and says welcome and lets you through. That's his job. The mindful presence during unsupported tranquility, when we're just resting in nowness, needs to be like this doorman, simply opening up and allowing everything to come into your mind. You should be aware of whatever happens inside your mind, but try not to follow it. The doorman doesn't hug people when they arrive. He just says hello. Maybe not even says hello, just lets them in. And nor does he follow people in or out. Similarly, you're neither particularly trying to keep something nor trying to reject anything. The main point is to be aware and to stay with the present moment, undistracted. Shamatha with support, like with the breath, would be like placing something in the door to keep it closed. So it's a little bit more, we're not letting in, if we're focusing just on the breath, we're not actually letting in all the sensory data so much. Still, that we do keep the eyes open and the ears somewhat open, But we're so focused on the breath that it's kind of like shutting the senses a little bit. Putting something in the door to keep it closed. The door is shut, so a lot of attachment and aversion doesn't arise. Nobody can go in or out, but there's also no compassion, sense of trust, or bodhicitta. So this is another advantage of this unsupported shamatha. It's very open. It's letting everything in, so there can be we're letting in the world, so there is a very subtle type of compassionate openness there, and trust. This, when we're just in the breath, we're like, everything else is like, okay, stay away here, you know, we're just trying to hear. This is like, it's a trusting mind to be open enough to let in sounds. This is just, you know, we're still not talking about like Vipassana meditation, but just this, even this calm abiding has some openness and trust, just to let in whoever comes at the door. In the case of shamatha without support, the doorman is busy opening the door and saying hello. He doesn't block the door, but sometimes he misses people coming in or going out. He tries to be very alert, but sometimes he dozes off or becomes dull or gets carried away because a beautiful object goes by that he wants to go after. Sometimes very ugly, smelly people show up and he wants to close the door. Sometimes he runs after someone and ends up following him or her into the toilet. And sometimes very strange people arrive. So stuff's coming into the mind, but we're not following it. We're not blocking out stuff. We're not following it either. But sometimes very strange people arrive. Let's say a huge, strong guy comes along, thick-necked, his head half-shaven with dragon tattoos on his bulging, muscled arms. In this kind of situation, the doorman does not have the power to block him. He tries to say, I'll let you go, I'll let you go. But this big guy does not let him go. Sometimes you letting go is not enough. Sometimes you need vipassana to let go of strong emotions or habits. That strong guy, the strong thought can grab you because you're meditating. If you keep hold of something, you also risk losing it. Calm abiding is an act of meditating, so it can be lost, while vipassana is actually not an act of meditating on something, so there's no risk of it getting lost. This is a little precursor to as we start talking about vipassana or non-meditation, where there's not even the sense of nowness. But for now, the important thing is not to fall into the dullness, into the oblivion kind of meditation. Particularly when we're trying to practice calm abiding without support. And I think if we do, if we're feeling that more sleepy, then maybe better to just do calm abiding with support. Use the breath. The breath will keep us more focused. But when we feel really awake and clear sometimes, even the breath can be too much. You know, just rest in nowness, totally awake and alert, and noticing, very careful, alert doorman, letting everything in, but noticing if discursive activity starts to get in there, and gently, not heavy-handedly, gently. Okay, no, just you're not about right now. You're about later. You're about before. Right now, we're just now. It's hard to stay on that tightrope. And I think in general, if we spend a lot of time in sleepiness, just this kind of schedule can do that, especially just arriving, getting up at 4 or something in the morning. If we're not used to that schedule, we might spend a lot of the day just being like, well, I'm like, my time zone is off. I think we get used to the schedule more and more, and also meditation, I think, gives us energy. But if we're really sleepy a lot, really, you know, rest well on breaks, really, don't get too busy, hopefully. And in Zazen, sometimes the sleepiness is just resistance. It's not, we're not maybe even physically, we've had enough sleep maybe, and it's just like the tedium of sitting day after day and like, what am I doing again? So at those times we can bring forth how do we inspire ourselves? Sometimes it's like, Keizan mentions, you know, reciting some Dharma teaching that we might know. Sometimes that, like that, that first paragraph of the Jijyu Zamai, or the first paragraph of the Fukan Zazengi, or little bits and pieces that you might know about, you know, now all Buddhas and all ancestors have made it the true path of enlightenment to sit upright, practicing in the midst of self-fulfilling samadhi. Those who attain enlightenment in India and China follow this way. Something like this reminds us that we're not alone, that we're all the Buddhas and ancestors have followed this way. Something to arouse our faith, actually, and trust and conviction. I think that's when sometimes we can get sleepy too, is like, maybe this isn't quite right, and this isn't really the way, and I don't even remember what the way is, I've lost my faith to a greater or lesser extent. And how we arouse that sometimes is just remembering that many people have done this before us and have have practiced with such trust, and it's been, they've benefited the world through such practice. And seeing the precious gift we have of this time in Zazen, rare opportunity to put everything aside for a day like this. And feeling that passage of time, sometimes we can space out for a period, and then the bell rings, and that was a whole period gone, and that was a whole morning gone, and we have one less. So, you know, in the next half hour, for those doing the whole Zazen, in half an hour we'll be exactly halfway through our 7 days. So it's not like it's the peak and now it's all downhill. It's it's all uphill to the very last moment. I read a little bit of this yesterday from Suzuki Roshi. To exist in big mind is an act of faith, which is different from the usual faith of believing in a particular idea or being. It is to believe that something is supporting us and supporting all our activities, including thinking mind and emotional feelings. All these things are supported by something big that has no form or color. It's impossible to know what it is, but something exists there, something that is neither material nor spiritual. Something like that always exists, and we exist in that space. That is the feeling of pure being. To exist in big mind is an act of faith. If you are brave enough to throw yourself into Zazen for 7 days, a little bit of understanding will help your rigidity and your stubbornness. almost all the problems you create because of your stubborn mind will vanish. If you have even the smallest understanding of reality, your way of thinking will change completely, and the problems you create will not be problems anymore. Tomorrow we'll start talking about vipassana, the insight into reality. But it's also true that as long as we live, we will have problems. So we don't practice zazen to attain some big enlightenment that will change our whole being or solve all our problems. That's not the right understanding. That may be what people call zen, but true zen is not like that. In sesshin, we concentrate on having the experience of true practice. Forgetting all about any idea of gaining anything, we just sit here. If this room is too cold, we'll make it warm, and if your legs become painful, you can stretch them. And if it's too difficult, you can rest. But let's continue our practice for these 7 days. Thank you very much. Sojin Roshi, right, said, this was yesterday's talk, if you have a lot of pain in your legs, somebody asks him, should you move or should you grit your teeth? And he said, neither, just release having to do anything, just surrender to this body in pain. And the person persisted and said, well, but should we move the legs or grit our teeth and fight it? And he said, well, if it's one or the other, then you should fight it. And we have to come to this point where we are forced into surrender sometimes. But Suzuki Roshi very kindly says here, if it's too cold, we'll make it warmer. If it's too warm, we'll make it cooler. If we're in pain, move your legs, because it's a lot to just be here day after day. So our effort is please to just continue with this opportunity for present, alert, wakeful, calm, abiding. Deep exhalation. Anything else today? We dedicate any merit arising, any point in this sesshin, to the complete perfect awakening of all living beings. May they realize inconceivable freedom and joy in the vast ocean of eternal brightness. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable, I vow to become it.